Okay, so some of you are sending me emails with requests for music, and I'm really happy about that. And today was the first day, and I'll be playing as many as I can, you know, before the class ends. So, and thank God for iTunes, right? You know, I don't have all this stuff already, but boom, you've got it. Where we left off last time was the regulation of gene transcription in E. coli, in prokaryotes. And E. coli change the rates of transcription of genes depending on the environment. And a good example is depending on what food's in the environment, they will synthesize the enzymes required to break down that food ultimately into glucose for energy. And we talked a lot about the lac operon and how lactose induces transcription of the lac operon. And that's the popular, well-known half, but there's another side to it, and it's that a different sugar, glucose, inhibits beta-galactosidase induction. And the experiment is if you mix lactose and glucose together and give it to the bacteria, they will not start to induce lac operon transcription until all of the glucose has gone into the glycolysis. And of course, glucose is the best sugar. Doesn't have to be, goes directly into glycolysis. Lactose, you have to spend energy to make beta-galactosidase to break it down into, you know, glucose and galactose. So it makes perfect sense, but molecularly, how does the bacteria do it? And the way it does is that glucose is regulating the lac operon with a protein called CRP. It's regulating the glucose response. With a protein called CRP, cyclic AMP receptor protein, and cyclic AMP. And here's what CRP looks like. This is the double-stranded DNA. Actually, this is the DNA just to the left of the promoter of the lac operon. So here's the lac operon. There's the promoter. There's the CRP binding site. There's the operator. That's where repressor binds. And you can see that it has this site-specific DNA binding capacity. Its shape and charges are very complementary to the DNA sequence of this, of what we call the CRP binding site. And it's also an allosteric enzyme. It has the capacity to bind cyclic AMP. That's what cyclic AMP looks like. And we'll see how it's synthesized and what its relationship to glucose is in a second. And it has a binding site for that molecule, and nothing else will fit in there. Okay? So this is the kind of the beauty and precision of enzymes, their ability to bind to specific sites, their ability to have pockets where specific small molecules can bind to them. And CRP is an allosteric enzyme. In an analogous way, the repressor is an allosteric enzyme. Its shape differs depending on whether it binds to lactose or not. The shape and activity of CRP also change depending on whether it's bound to cyclic AMP. Okay, so let's kind of pull this story together. Cyclic AMP, as it turns out in bacteria, is a glucose sensor. It's the way the bacteria, the E. coli, monitors how much glucose it has. Okay, so it's a little bit indirect, but you know, life is not always direct. This is how the bacteria does it. And so how is cyclic AMP made? It's a simple reaction. ATP basically self-hydrolyzes. It uses the 3' hydroxyl to attack this phosphate. Pyrophosphate is the leaving group, and that forms this very curious phosphodiester linkage that kind of makes a loop here, and that's cyclic AMP. That's why that's called cyclic. And the enzyme that catalyzes this reaction is called adenyl cyclase. And for reasons that are not abundantly clear, or at least not abundantly clear to me, but glucose inhibits adenyl cyclase, this enzyme. And therefore, glucose inhibits this reaction. So if glucose is in the cell, this reaction does not take place. If glucose is high, then the level of the product of this reaction, cyclic AMP concentration, is low. If glucose is absent, if glucose is low, then adenyl cyclase is very active and it's producing cyclic AMP. So that's how the bacteria uses cyclic AMP. It's just it's an inverse situation. Glucose low, cyclic AMP high, glucose high, cyclic AMP low. But cyclic AMP, see, you can stop and think. Why doesn't it just use glucose? Can anyone think about why glucose might not be as good a signaling molecule as this? This just came to the top of my head. And glucose is a signaling molecule in other things. But glucose has a lot less structure. It's just this little, ring of carbons. And cyclic AMP has a lot of beautiful structure. And so maybe it was easier to design enzymes that would just bind this as and in these very precise binding sites as opposed to making glucose the binding site. That's all with big quotation marks if you read in the journal, glucose, new signaling molecule. Don't, come back to me. I was just thinking out loud. But it doesn't use glucose directly. It uses cyclic AMP through this mechanism. Cyclic AMP regulates a lot of things in E. coli because it's really shifting things around depending on whether glucose is there or not. Okay, so now let's see how this kind of works with the lac operon. So as I said, here's the RNA polymerase binding site, here's the operator site, and here's the CRP binding site. And what's not shown on, and this is the lac repressor gene, but what's not shown on this slide is the CRP gene. So it's, the E. coli chromosome is circular, so it's somewhere, but it has its own gene and its own promoter, and it's being transcribed at a low level all the time. And when CRP is the gene is transcribed, the RNA translated, it comes off the assembly line in an inactive form. So, when it's just sitting there, just after it's been translated, it's not active. But if it combines, so its shape, when I say inactive, its shape is not correct for binding this DNA. But if cyclic AMP is there, it will bind. It will undergo an allosteric transition. Its shape will change. And now it can bind this specific sequence. And when it does bind, it helps RNA polymerase bind. And it turns out for this promoter, this RNA polymerase binding site, E. coli RNA polymerase cannot directly bind this all by itself. There are other promoters in E. coli where it can, but this particular one, it cannot. It requires the help of the CRP. Whether that helps it find the site or whether it helps it open up those DNA strands so it can initiate transcription. But without CRP, the ability to initiate transcription is dropped about 50-fold, which is a very big difference. So when CRP is active because it's bound to cyclic AMP, it binds to its binding site, helps RNA polymerase, and now you get transcription of the lac operon. And so we can see this in the, I always like you to fill things in, and I know I always go through this a little quickly. And by the way, any image that you see that's not in your book has been uploaded to the B-space, as well as all of these filled in. So there's the CRP gene with its own promoter, transcription, translation, inactive CRP, and in this particular case, there's no glucose. That means there's lots of cyclic AMP, so it binds, and it changes its shape in response to that. Also, in this case, there is lactose. So here's the I gene. There's transcription, translation. Notice the kind of difference. And it's just all designed to make the system work. When CRP comes off the ribosome, it's inactive and requires a small molecule to become active. It's just the opposite for the repressor. When it comes off the ribosome, it is active. It can bind to the operator. But in this case, there's lactose. It binds to it, changes its shape, and it can't bind. So what's going to happen here? Well, CRP is going to help a very happy RNA polymerase. It's going to undergo transcribe the lac operon. There's IPTG in this cell. And so you get a nice big blue cell. Okay. Just pausing. Okay. So what happens when there is glucose, okay? So now CRP is not active because when there is glucose, there's no cyclic AMP. polymerase. So that means there's nothing sitting at the CRP binding site. Polymerase doesn't know what to do. And even though there is lactose in the media, there's both glucose and lactose, and the repressor is in a shape where it can't bind, so it's inactive, RNA polymerase can't transcribe. So nothing will happen at this operon until all of that glucose gets catabolized, goes into glycolysis, and only then will transcription begin. So we can see the phenotype of a wild-type CRP plus bacteria when there is glucose. Inactive CRP is made by transcription translation. There is no cyclic AMP because of the glucose. Repressor is, gene, I gene, is transcribed. It's active, binds to lactose, becomes inactive. But RNA polymerase is off on the sidelines transcribing other genes, and so the cell, is white. Okay. So here's a question for you. How would you identify bacteria with a loss of function mutation in the CRP gene? Earlier in the lecture, we talked about how Jacob and Manot identified a bacteria in a mutagenized population of cells that made colonies, and they found that rare I-minus mutant simply by looking at it, the color. And they set it up so that the wild-type cells with the I-plus cells were white and the I-minus colony was blue. Could you think of something like that, where you could see a CRP mutant in a background of large number of wild-type cells? And the hint is look at this part here, because this is where the phenotypes differ. Wild-type is inducible, so when lactose is there, the lac operon is being transcribed. The CRP mutant's not inducible. Okay, if it's CRP minus, even you can add lactose, the repressor gets inactivated, but there will be no transcription. So when you think of setting it up, you should focus on this part of the graph. Okay, that's something to think about. And I can't ask you that kind of question on an exam, because how do you make that into a multiple choice question? You know, but if you can answer those kinds of questions, and if you can fill in those cells, whether I plus or I minus, O plus, O minus, CRP plus, CRP minus, then you understand the system and you can answer the simple multiple choice questions that you see on your final. Okay, so this is a nice summary, and it just shows the four possible nutrient states that E. coli can encounter with regards to glucose and lactose. So let's just go through all four to kind of consolidate everything. So if the E. coli cell is in the presence of glucose and lactose, repressor bound to the operator with that lactose? No. Lactose doesn't bind and activates the repressor. If there's lots of glucose, is the cyclic AMP high or low? Well, it has to be low. It's just the inverse. If there's no cyclic AMP, is the cyclic AMP CRP bound to its binding site? No. Is there transcription? No. Polymerase can't bind. Let's look at the next one. There is glucose. There's no lactose. Okay. Oh. I did that too fast. Is the repressor bound? Yes, it is bound, because there's no lactose to inactivate it by binding to it. Cyclic AMP, because of high glucose, is down. Is the CRP here? No, because of the glucose. And the no lack of cyclic AMP, is there transcription? No, double no. There's the repressor in the way, and there's no CRP to help RNA polymerase bind. Third situation, there's no glucose or lactose. Is the repressor bound? Yes, because there's no lactose. Cyclic AMP now is going to be high. That's going to allow CRP to bind. But even if it can help RNA polymerase try to bind here, the repressor is standing in the way. So there's no transcription. And the final situation, there is no glucose. There is lactose. Is the repressor bound? No, that's because there's lactose. Is cyclic AMP high? Yes, because there's no glucose. Is CRP bound? Yes. Is RNA polymerase bound? Yes. Is there transcription? Yes. And so that's this beautiful little molecular switch. So it's not just on-off. It allows the E. coli to discriminate between food sources and transcribe when it makes sense. And it does that by having two different regulators converge onto this promoter. The CRP binding protein is one regulator, and it has its own small molecule, cyclic AMP, and the repressor is the other regulator, and it has lactose as its small molecule that it binds to. Both are allosteric enzymes. Very beautiful system. So the important definitions here about positive and negative regulators. So regulation of lac operon expression by positive and negative regulators. So let's define them. And this ties in with this picture here. Wild type is expressed when inducer is present, not expressed when the inducer is absent. We call that an inducible system. So if you follow this, it's off, and then you add inducer, and it's on. Wild type here is in white. And so that's inducible. Inducible means you can turn it on, and you can turn it off if you remove the inducer. A loss of function, and this is a definition. This is how you define, how you know something is a negative regulator. A loss of function mutation in a negative regulator, for example, gene I, results in expression when inducer is present or absent. It's always on, and we call that constitutive, and that's here. Okay, so if you mutate a negative regulator, you go from an inducible system to a expressor to situation to a constitutive expression situation. And a loss of function in a positive regulator gene like CRP results in no expression, whether the inducer is there or not. We call that non-inducible expression. So there are three states here: inducible, constitutive, non-inducible. And these are why we'll call the repressor a negative regulator and CRP a positive regulator, because this is the definitions of those words. And if you stay in the business, you will encounter and probably study negative and positive regulators in your lifetime. So, and it's the fact that there are multiple positive and negative regulators that allow this simple organism, E. coli, to make this pretty sophisticated molecular decision. The lac operon's only transcribed when glucose is absent, when lactose is present. And this is an example of what we call combinatorial control of transcription. Combinatorial just means that it's the combination of multiple regulators converging on a promoter to make a more sophisticated choice about whether it will be transcribed or not. And it turns out this is very common, particularly for the promoters in your body, where you have to make very sophisticated transcription decisions about when to transcribe genes, and this is what's on the board here. A lot of information is coming in forms of transcription finders, factors that are binding to sites that then converge on the promoter to help make this decision of whether to transcribe or not. Questions on prokaryote gene regulation. And this is you know, there's no time to talk about the TRIP operon, but you should read about it and understand it as if we went through it in class. So there will be a TRIP question on the midterm exam. So you should look at that. And we can discuss it in section. Okay, so we're going to shift now. And do you have questions on anything I've ever said on the lac operon? Okay. We're going to now talk about eukaryote gene expression. Boy, if you thought the lac operon was tough, this is a lot going on in how eukaryotes like us regulate gene expression. And the first thing I have to do is to find something, gene expression. A gene is expressed when it makes a functional product, and that product, depending on the gene, can be RNA or proteins. Okay, so expression is a bigger word than regulation of transcription. Regulation of transcription is right here with RNA polymerase and things like that. Regulation of expression is this whole thing work. All the way from, is the chromatin in the right state? Are the right transcription factors there? Is it being transcribed? Is the RNA being spliced? Is it being capped and tailed? Is it being transported into the cytoplasm when it gets there? Is it rapidly degraded, or does it get to be translated? If it's translated, does the protein rapidly get degraded, or does it get to fold into the right conformation? Has it undergone the proper processing? Did it go to the right organelle? And finally, is there something waiting for it, you know, does it start to carry out its reaction? This whole process is called expression. And because there are so many steps, there are lots of places to regulate it. lots of places to influence whether it's happening or not. I told you that that at the transcription level, this still is the most common place to regulate this. So we'll talk about it first, regulation of gene transcription in eukaryotes. But there are other important regulatory steps. And before we leave this class and leave each other, we'll talk about the regulation of chromatin structure that's above gene transcription. We're going to talk, of course, about transcription factors. And then I wanted to tell you a little bit about regulatory RNAs that don't encode proteins, because it's a nice new exploding field. It's very modern, contemporary, and the people that discovered it have already won their Nobel Prizes. So, wow, must be important. Okay, and this is the reading. And sorry, it's all skipping around now, 16, 18, 19, you know. And the order of the reading is not the order of presentation, but I thought you should read the text at least in order that it appears in the text. But, you know, sorry, I can't follow either of these, but these are the sections that have most of the material that I'll be presenting. Okay. So the first thing we're going to talk about is the regulation of gene transcription by transcription factors, and they can be mentally divided into two classes, general and regular. Sometimes they're called regulatory, sometimes they're called specific, and sometimes they're just called transcription factors for this second class. But let's start with what we call, general transcription factors. Okay. So this is where transcription is initiated. And so just downstream of this, that's the gene that wants to be transcribed and make an RNA and be translated. Okay. And here is a TA-rich region. And you will notice that RNA E. coli bacteria basically have one RNA polymerase. But eukaryote cells have three RNA polymerases that divide up the work of transcribing all the different genes. RNA polymerase 1, if the projectionist could come to the board, that would be great. RNA polymerase 1 specializes in transcribing ribosomal RNA genes, except for the 5S RNA gene. It doesn't transcribe that, but the 16S, the 23S, there are actually quite a few copies of those genes, and it's just transcribing them. RNA polymerase 2 is the workhorse, in my mind. It transcribes all those genes that encode messenger RNAs that are translated, as well, okay, and, you know, I used to stop there, but now I have to add, as well as some genes encoding RNAs that are not translated that are important that we will touch upon later. But, you know, if it's a gene that makes a messenger RNA that's going to be translated, RNA polymerase was the one who transcribed that gene. RNA polymerase 3 translates actually quite a few of these sort of smaller genes, tRNA genes, 5S ribosomal RNA genes, and the snRNA, small nuclear RNA genes that we talked about for splicing. And because of time, we're going to focus right here, because this is where the genes that encode proteins are. So we're just going to focus on RNA polymerase 2. And so the people who studied RNA polymerase 2 found, you know, even in E. coli, it's four polypeptides, right? You know, two alphas and beta prime. In eukaryotes, as is always the case, it's even more complicated. RNA polymerase 2 is actually a complex of about 10 polypeptides. And it can't bind the promoter by itself. That's the general rule. In E. coli, sometimes RNA polymerase combines, sometimes not. It depends on the promoter. But the general rule in eukaryotes is RNA polymerase needs help always. This complex of 10 polypeptides wants to bind, likes to bind, but can't bind. Okay, it needs other proteins to help it. And that's the function of the general transcription factors, to help it achieve at least a low level of transcription, okay? So they, of binding and therefore transcription. So they help RNA polymerase 2 bind to the promoter. And among the general transcription factors, TF2D, which is how you say general transcription factor 2D, it actually is the one that binds this TA-rich sequence that's sometimes called the Tata box. That's very close to the start of transcription. So we can go back to the image. And how was all this figured out? It was once more people instead of using E. coli, they used animal tissue culture cells, and they would make extracts and isolate and purify the proteins that could make all of this happen in vitro. So they were in vitro, they studied in vitro transcription in a test tube, and they asked what proteins were needed and what is the order of addition. And they found that what they call TF2D, which was a name that was given to it by how it came off of a column chromatography during the purification procedure, and Bob Tejan in MCB was a pioneer in doing these kinds. Here at UC Berkeley was a pioneer in designing and discovering some of these proteins, general transcription factors. And so what they found was the actual DNA binding protein in the whole complex is TF2D. And it can bind to this TA-rich region. And when it does bind, its job, it doesn't directly bind RNA polymerase. It actually calls in some other general transcription factors. And most notably, you'll see TF2B is very important. And together, they help bring in RNA polymerase, which has to be modified by phosphorylation, and then off it goes. Notice when RNA polymerase finally starts to transcribe, it leaves all those general transcription factors behind. Okay, so the analogy I always give is that you have all been to SFO and you see the jet plane and, you know, the little trucks going around it and they're putting things in and people are all walking around and they're like all the general transcription factors. But when it's at the beginning of the runway, everybody stands back, okay, because this is going to go. And when the airplane leaves, no one's close to it, it flies. And when transcription begins, RNA polymerase, just like you saw in that movie, it flies, and there are no general transcription factors along for the ride. Okay. And what this does is it, you know, if this whole thing works, it results in what we call a low basal rate of transcription initiation. So it's like playing the music very softly. And if you want the music loud, there have to be regulatory transcription factors that are going to make this process happen a lot more efficiently. So that's our segue, our transition into regulatory transcription factors, or sometimes called specific transcription factors, or sometimes just called transcription factors. They are required for high-level transcription. You will find they come in different flavors. There are activators that increase the rate of transcription initiation, and there are repressors that make it go even worse, okay, that take it down even further. And their activities, which is analogous, which also means their shapes, can be modified by signals, just like we saw with the lac operon, where lactose and cyclic AMP were changing the shape of allosteric enzymes, changing their activities. This is going on in eukaryotes too. A lot of these changes are phosphorylation or not, whether a transcription factor is phosphorylated or not. You'll hear about those kinds of so there are signals that come into the cell, and it results in phosphorylation of proteins and dephosphorylation, and it starts at the membrane, phosphorylation. So a little phosphate basically is being transferred from the receptor on the outside of the cell that receives the information from outside. Phosphorylation kinase, finally the transcription factor is phosphorylated. I'm active, I transcribe. So that is what you'll be seeing in subsequent classes, where a signal from the environment is transmitted deep into the cell all the way to a transcription factor that then goes to work and transcribes the genes that are an appropriate response to the new signal in the environment, for example. Okay, but we're going to talk about something more simple than that. We're going to a new model organism called yeast, baker's yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and it is a great genetic organism. When I wrote this slide, I was, oh, so beautiful, genetics, you know. It's a unicellular eukaryote, so that's the good part. It is a bona fide eukaryote. You know, kind of looks like bacteria. All the yeast geneticists would kill me if they heard that, when it's just shaking in a flask. But it is a eukaryote, no mistake about it. It's got linear chromosomes. It undergoes meiosis. They're pairing, anaphase. The whole thing is working. And you can isolate mutants. And what's really cool, and I'm going to disappear for a second, but I will come back. So when it's haploid, it can conjugate or mate to make a diploid. When it's diploid, it can undergo meiosis to make the haploid. You can isolate mutants when it's haploid and see their phenotypes. You can create heterozygotes and know who's dominant and recessive in the diploid generation. So it's just a beautiful genetic organism. It has a very short life cycle. You can do all those kind of microbial, very sophisticated genetics and mutant screens, isolating mutations, just like you can do in bacteria, but it's a eukaryote. It's yeast. Rapid reproduction, has a very small genome, 1.3 times 10 to the 7th base pairs. And it was one of the first eukaryote. It probably was the first eukaryote genome that was sequenced. And that's, of course, been completed for quite a while now. This shows a cell division. And so that little one is actually has a nucleus the same as this, with the same amount of genetic material. And it will bud off and then grow. So we're going to talk about the regulation of galactose-inducible gene transcription. And I chose this because it's a little bit close to what we talked about in the lacoperon, but it shows the unique properties of eukaryotic gene transcription and the regulation thereof. A lot of the rules and concepts that you learn still work, but there are some new things. So here's the pathway. Here's galactose. In order to use this as energy, it has to go, three enzymes have to catalyze reactions to make it glucose-1-phosphate that can enter glycolysis. The precise reactions of these enzymes aren't important now, and collectively I call them the galactose catabolism enzymes. Okay. So whenever you see on a slide galactose catabolism enzyme, it means Gal-1, Gal-7, and Gal-10. Okay. And yeast, just like E. coli, they're a single-celled organism. They have to make these choices and only transcribe and translate these genes when galactose is in the environment. But remember I said this, and this is true. Eukaryotes don't have operons. There is not a Gal operon. These are not all behind one promoter with an operator and all that stuff. Each one is a different gene with its own promoter, and they're probably on different chromosomes. Okay, so the regulation has to have some differences. So the question is, how is their transcription coordinately activated? Because if you go from a non-galactose to a galactose environment, all of these go from no transcription to high transcription. So this is an inducible system. And so people entered it and tried to understand what was going on the same way they entered and tried to understand the lacoperon. They used genetics. They isolated mutations that changed this inducible pattern of transcription of the galactose catabolism enzymes. So here's a wild type. And you add inducer, and off it goes, lots of transcription. And so one interesting mutation that they identified was in a gene that they named Gal-4. And it goes to a non-inducible state. Okay, you can add inducer all you want. It's not transcribed. It's non-inducible. Is Gal-4 a positive or negative regulator? Make me happy. Yes, positive. Yes. It's positive because when you mutate it, the system doesn't turn on. That means it's playing, the wild type version is a positive helper. It's allowing this induction, it's required for this induction to take place. If it's broken, there is no induction. Great. Okay, and so getting the mutation told them that the gene existed, getting the mutation allowed them to map it, and using techniques that we're going to talk about later on, it actually allowed them to go right to that gene, sequence its message, know the amino acid sequence of the protein, make antibodies to the protein, study the protein, do all kinds of experiments, and all that's coming in terms of technology that we're going to talk about. But in the end, what was it? Gal4 is a transcription factor. It's a specific transcription factor, regulatory one. And it's of a class called zinc finger. And you remember how the LAC repressor had beautiful alpha helices that laid down into the groove of the DNA and read the sequence? Well, this is just a different way to get the amino acids to lay down into the groove. And so instead of alpha helices, it's called a zinc finger. And what it is this is the polypeptide chain. And here is a zinc cation, double plus charge. And there are different, they come in, you know, different varieties, but the general rule is these cysteines with their sulfur amino acids, the slightly negative charge, likes to interact with the zinc. And so these amino acids wrap around this zinc cation, and it makes a finger or a portion of the protein that is the right shape to lay down into the groove and then read the DNA sequence with these other amino acids. Okay. So Gal4 is called a zinc finger transcription factor. Okay, and it binds into the major groove. This is a space-filling model now, double-stranded DNA. And these are zinc fingers. This is actually a dimer, and these are zinc fingers laying down into the DNA. Okay, the Gal4, if you look at it, it has what are called multiple domains, okay? And this is very common, that proteins have multiple domains. So I should try to, it has a DNA binding domain, and that's just what we talked about. That's the part of the protein that has this zinc finger. But it has a second domain, and it's negatively charged. That's its special property. Lots of glutamic acids and aspartic acid, amino acids that have that nice negative charge. And that's called the activation domain. And in a minute, we'll see how it works. But that's the part that actually increases the rate of RNA polymerase II transcription initiation. So what do I mean by domains? Well, if this is the Gal4 messenger RNA, you know, there was a gene, it was transcribed, exons removed, introns removed, you know, and when you finally get out into the cytoplasm, here's the message, and it gets translated. So this is the polypeptide from amino to carboxyl end. And then these amino acids fold together to make the DNA binding domain. And these amino acids, you know, undergo protein folding and are in this region of the protein to make the negatively charged activation domain. So this is one single polypeptide, but it's broken into two domains with really separate functions. Okay, and then this you can call a little linker domain that really has only one job, is just to connect. Well, you know, so these are all part of one protein. But these are actually function quite independently. If you chop that up, this will still bind. This will still activate, but it needs the DNA binding domain to get down to the DNA to be able to activate transcription. So that, the point of that image is multiple domains and what are they. And the other point, and this was the major surprise, first major difference between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. Prokaryotes, there's a, you know, the TA-rich region where RNA polymerase wants to bind. And if right next to it is the operator and the CRP binding site. And these sites are like here and here and here. It is as close as they can be. In fact, they even overlap. Okay, so that's a general rule of prokaryotes. They want the genome to be as small as possible so they can replicate it as fast as possible. And so everything is compressed. If I drew it to scale, the LAC operon is just squished in like this. But eukaryotic genes, here's the gene, here's the promoter, the places where these transcription factors bind, they're far away. They can easily be far away from the promoter. Okay? Space is not a problem in a eukaryotic genome. The genes are far apart, everything is separated, and there's lots of open territory to place sequences that bind transcription factors that send in information to the promoter about whether to transcribe or not. And so I tried to, I really can't draw this to scale because I can't make this small enough, or you won't be able to see it, and I can't make this big enough, or it's just going to take up the whole board. But your genome is big, and you have, and you use that space, and the one way you use it is by having all of these regulatory sequences. But the, and go back to the image. But they can be pretty far away from the start of RNA transcription. Make no mistake, this is still important. It's still required to get RNA polymerase to bind here, but the actual binding site is far away. In this slide, this one, in this case, it's 250 base pairs. It can easily be 2,000 or even sometimes, you know, more than that. Okay, so how can they act at such a different distance? And it's because there's some flexibility here and because the DNA is not rigid, okay, and it can loop around. So, so for example, TF2D, the general transcription factor, binds to the TA-rich sequence here, and one of its, one of the rate-limiting steps is its ability to bind to TF2B that then leads to bringing in our other general transcription factors and RNA polymerase. It turns out this negative charged face of Gal4, when this loops around, it creates the right environment for this interaction. So this becomes, this is actually a rate limiting step for transcription initiation, this association between TF2D and B, and that rate limiting step is accelerated in the environment of this negatively charged face of the activation domain of Gal4. So the DNA binding domain binds, brings it to this site, and then the DNA loops around and then brings the negative charge face into this area, and that's how it accelerates the rate of the transcription initiation. And you can see this is a positive regulator. It's helping. It's helping. It's promoting. Okay. So since these enzymes are not organized in an operon, each one has its own promoter. They have their own position in the genome. But so how does Gal4, and it's pretty simple, how does Gal4 coordinate and activate the transcription of all three of them? It simply does it by, the, it can do it because, oh, and these, sorry, definition time. This Gal4 DNA binding site, they call that an enhancer. It's a little bit jargony, but that's what it's called. And these sites... So these are different enhancers for different transcription factors. They have different sequences. They bind to different transcription factors. But the kind of word people use for these sites that bind specific transcription factors that are often far away from the promoter where RNA polymerase will bind, those are called enhancers. And what they found was you can move this around. So people have the skill of taking genes out, moving, changing things. You can move this further over here, you can put it even downstream, put it back into the organism, and they find it still works, it still activates. So this whole perfect positioning is not important because of the ability of the DNA to loop around and make it right. Okay? Okay. So now, how does Gal4 coordinately activate? Gal1, 7 and 10. Get ready for another email. You're going to have to correct that. Okay? Sorry about that. So here's Gal4, and here's Gal1, 7, and 10, and Gal4 binds to the identical, essentially identical enhancer sequence that's upstream of these genes. It loops around and activates the transcription of all three of them. So that's, it's not hard, but it's not an operon, and so keep them separate. Okay, what about the other half? There's another gene called Gal80, and they also, they found Gal80 by, when they did mutagenesis and looked for yeast that were constitutively transcribing Gal1, 7, and 10 all the time, whether inducer was there or not. Okay? So that's wild type, inducible expression. Here's Gal80. Constitutive expression is Gal80. Anyway, I changed this sentence too. It's in your thing. Is Gal80 a positive or negative regulator? Don't look at your, yeah. Okay, I am definitely working too hard. Okay, fine. Another email coming. Is Gal80 a positive or negative regulator? Great, you guys are great, good. Okay, so the model for Gal-80. What Gal-80 is doing is Gal-80 in the wild type is repressing transcription when there's no inducer. Because if you don't have it, it bumps up and becomes constitutive. Okay. And what researchers found is that when there is no inducer, what Gal-80 does is it says, I like this negative face of charges. I like it even more. I like it so much that I'm not going to share it with anybody. And Gal-80 binds to it. And when Gal-80 is binding to it, this can't happen because Gal-80 is in the way. And so it can't activate the rate of transcription. Okay, so that's the situation when there is no galactose. When there is galactose, Gal-80 can't carry out that function. And one way to think about it is that galactose binds to it and changes its shape. But actually, some recent results suggest there's another protein involved, but in the end, you know, that complexity is not the point. So galactose prevents Gal-80 from binding Gal-4. Now Gal-4 can loop around and activate transcription. Okay. So this slide is talking about eukaryotic promoters, and this is an image from your text, either from the 8th edition or the 7th edition. And there are a couple points. The point that they're trying to make here is that you're a multicellular organism, and so you have different kinds of cells. You have a liver cell and a lens cell, for example, and you have genes that are expressed in the liver cell and not in the genes that are expressed in the liver cell and genes that are not. And conversely, you have genes that are not expressed in the lens cell in your eye, but that are expressed in the lens cell. And how do you control that? And the way you control it is by having different specific transcription factors in these two different cells. And they will make the right genes be transcribed because they will bind to their enhancer sequences and it will greatly increase the rate of transcription. And the array of transcription factors here in the liver cell is different than the lens cell. So that's a very important thing, is to, as these cells take on their specific fates and functions, they acquire a certain set of transcription factors that will transcribe the right genes to make the right proteins for these cells to function. And that's a lot of decision making. And, you know, we could clearly show how E. coli could respond to lactose plus glucose by having multiple binding sites and multiple transcription factors influencing transcription of the lac operon. And that's what all of these enhancers are doing. They're binding to different transcription factors that all have to be right to make this, to allow transcription to occur. And so you see, you need a lot more information. You're not just trying to distinguish between glucose and lactose. Your genes are trying to say, they're having an identity crisis. What kind of cell am I in? Am I in a liver cell or am I in a lens cell? For example, hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is on your red blood cells. It's only transcribed in cells that are developing to become red blood cells. Hemoglobin gene is not transcribed in your skin cells. Okay, it's being transcribed in a certain cell type at a certain stage of development. And as you'll see in subsequent lectures, you have multiple hemoglobin genes. Some of them are being transcribed in those cells when you're an adult. Some of them, different ones, were being transcribed when you were a fetus. Different ones were being transcribed when you were an embryo. And so how is all that regulated? By the fact that those different cells have different transcription factors, binding to their enhancers and activating transcription. So that's the combinatorial control that's so essential for all these decisions that have to be made. Okay. And these are the few questions I could glean out of the book about eukaryotic gene transcription. And do you have questions for me? Well, you know something? It's Friday. And we have 60 seconds, so I think why don't we enjoy them. So you're excused. And I will see you on Monday. Thanks. I enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you.